Hello and welcome to this week's Dalek Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and those all over the world, including, I'm told, David in Israel and Robert in Perth. Hello, accessing the show over the internet. Our theme this week is war. A rather somber subject, but we have many guests here with which to discuss this. We feature the Spanish Civil War and a plaque to be unveiled in Bristol to commemorate the International Brigades. More of that later. Tony Arpino from San Francisco, now living in Bristol, is here to chat about San Francisco culture and how it compares to Bristol. And our features this week are by Tony Gosling. As always, the actor Malcolm Greaves, straight out of Swindon, reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, is here to read his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks, as ever, is going to give us his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week.
The Volunteer. Tell them in England, if they ask, what brought us to these wars, to this plateau beneath the night's grave manifold of stars. It was not fraud or foolishness, glory, revenge, or pay. We came because our open eyes could see no other way. There was no other way to keep man's flickering truth alight. These stars will witness that our course burned briefer, but not less bright.
That was a Cecil Day Lewis poem there, The Volunteer. I'm John Peters Coleman. I'd like to introduce to the studio for a little roundtable discussion Palmyra Sullivan, John Holliman, and from the International Brigade Memorial Trust, Duncan Longstaff and Mary Greening, to talk about the plaque to be unveiled soon in Bristol. But first, let's hear some audio and some information about the war.
The Spanish Civil War was a major conflict that devastated Spain from 17th July 1936 to the 1st of April 1939. It began after an attempted coup d'etat by the group of Spanish army generals against the government of the Second Spanish Republic, then under the leadership of President Manuel Azaña. The nationalist coup was supported by the conservative Spanish Confederation of the Autonomous Right Monarchists, known as the Carlist Groups, and the fascist Falange. Following the military coup, working-class revolutions spread across the country in support of the Republican government, but were all brutally put down by the army. The war ended with the victory of the nationalist forces, the overthrow of the Republican government, and the founding of a dictatorship led by General Francisco Franco. In the aftermath of the Civil War, all right-wing parties were fused into the state party of the Franco regime. Mm-hmm. Many non-Spanish people, often affiliated with radical communist or socialist parties or groups, joined the international brigades, believing that the Spanish Republic was the front line of the war against fascism. The troops of the international brigades represented the largest foreign contingent of those fighting for the Republicans. Roughly 30,000 foreign nationals from up to 53 nations fought in the brigades. Most of them were communists or trade unionists, and while organized by communists guided or controlled by Moscow, they were almost all individual volunteers.
At the beginning of 1939, a young reporter, Richard Dimbleby, covered the sad movement of refugees as the Spanish Civil War came to an end.
Everyone is agitated. The headquarters of the prefect are like a beehive, day and night and Sunday included. I've had to wait a total of nearly 9 hours for 2 special permits. I've shown them all together exactly 47 times. I've been asked if I carry arms 6 times and searched for them twice. And once last night, someone mistook me for a refugee and tried to push me into a cattle truck. Perhaps that sounds vaguely amusing, but the whole refugee problem here is intensely serious, and pathetic is the only word I can think of, unless perhaps tragic is better. There are thousands of them, mostly women and young children, coming over the 3 main entrances, Cerbère, Lepertus, and Bourg-Madame. Some of them are in the last stages of exhaustion. They're hungry, starving, many of them, and numbed with cold. In spite of the work of relief organizations and the scheme of evacuation which the French authorities have put into operation quite successfully, many of them have died.
Well, I'd like to introduce all of the guests here present. There's quite a few of us crammed in this little studio tonight. I'd like to welcome John Holloman. Hello.
Evening.
And you are a Spanish lecturer and teacher.
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to welcome Palmira Sullivan.
Hello.
From the Basque Country, I understand.
That's right.
Okay, yes. So whereabouts in the Basque Country?
I'm from San Sebastian, okay. Which is very near the French border.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to welcome from the International Brigade Memorial Trust, Duncan Longstaff and Mary Greening. Hello.
Hello.
You being a sort of knowledgeable, John, if I start with you on Spanish history, how did you find our informative introduction that we earthed up from the internet?
Well, I appreciated it a great deal. The music is always very evocative of what I always find the slightly sad side of Spain at times. We've got an image of it being a very bright and gay place, but it has its somber side, and of course the Spanish Civil War is the ultimate in the somber of that part of the world. And the poem is an excellent recapitulation of the international appeal that the Civil War had in the 1930s.
Do you ever feel that it kind of gets a little bit overshadowed by obviously the Second World War, and it's kind of like the minor cousin to a bigger event possibly?
Well, it's often been said that the Spanish Civil War was a precursor of the first example of the international war between fascism and communism, which is partly true, but the Spanish Civil War had its very local roots. It was the product of a great deal of turbulence in Spain in the 19th century and pressures that were building to be released, and ultimately in the search for a modern democratic state. And that had failed until 1931, when a republic was born. Hmm. And so the republic was a coming to maturity of Spain, but it failed because of the deep nature of the tensions that existed in Spanish society.
Okay, I'll move over to Duncan and Mary. Tell me a little bit about why, if it's a Spanish phenomenon, should the International Brigade and the Spanish Civil War, how do these connect and link the UK and Spain, and why should that Spanish Civil War be remembered here?
Well, the purpose of the International Brigade Memorial Trust is to preserve the memory of the volunteers who fought in Spain against fascism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose.
Okay, tell me a little bit about the International Brigade and the history of that.
The International Brigade was formed by the Comintern, and its formation was in October, September of 1936.
Okay.
Several months after the beginning of the conflict.
And where was it founded?
Well, I think it would be founded in Spain itself.
Yeah.
With the agreement of the Republican government.
Okay. And did they find a lot of volunteers coming from all over Europe, specific places?
All over the world.
All over the world?
Yes.
Okay.
From almost every nation, I would guess.
Okay. So at the height of their success, if you will, I mean, how many sort of people were helping the cause, fighting with the international brigades? Roughly.
Well, on my account, although the figures differ on this, it's about 45,000 recruits to the international brigades. And these figures are from the archives held in Moscow that have recently been opened to public scrutiny, if you like.
Okay, and what's your personal connection to the international
brigades? My father was a member of the British Battalion, which was part of the 15th Brigade,
yeah,
which was part of the Spanish Republican Army.
Okay, and how about yourself, Mary?
My father was also an international brigader and was part of the British Battalion. He came from South Wales, and South Wales was one of the areas that sent a large number of people to fight in Spain.
Okay.
But it wasn't just men who went, women went as well. They went as nurses and as administrators. Because it wasn't just people fighting in the Spanish Civil War. Other people went who couldn't necessarily fight for perhaps medical reasons, but worked in different ways.
There, a lot of behind the scenes.
There were a lot of yes, a certain number behind the scenes, and there was also a huge Spanish aid movement.
Okay.
Of local people.
And Mr. Duncan.
Another point in this is another reason that probably Mary and myself were interested in this and want to keep these memories alive, is that Franco, during his period in Spain, tried to eliminate all memory of the Spanish conflict, and we are determined to get the history written and known about in Spain and elsewhere throughout the world.
Okay. I'll move across to Palmyra. Hello.
Hello.
What is your how's it personally affected you and your life and the Spanish Civil War?
Well, at the moment I'm involved in refurbishing the International Brigade's memorial plaque in Castle Park, which was very difficult to find. So we've managed to put a mosaic frame around it in bright colours. In fact, the colours of the Republican flag.
Okay.
The Spanish Republican flag, and we're going to have a little ceremony on the 14th next Wednesday, which is the day that the Spanish Republic was proclaimed, actually, in 1931.
Okay.
I'm from a Republican family,
mm-hmm.
and you know, as all Republican families in Spain, who lost a lot of people.
Yeah.
My grandfather, who was 70. Was killed at the beginning of the war. One of my uncles died fighting in the street in the early days of the war, again to stop the fascists taking over my hometown.
Yeah.
Another one of my uncles had to go into exile in South America. And one of my uncles, who was a young man and fought in the war with the Republican Army, when the war finished, he tried to go back to his village. But he couldn't do that because he was threatened with death, you know, the people in the village. So he had to go and live in the Basque Country, where there was still a bit of, you know, Republican sympathy underground.
How did you find knowledge of Spain and what Spain experienced in the UK? Were you sort of disappointed by the ignorance of many people, or did you find quite a lot of people knew about it? Or?
Well, there are people, you know, people on the left, people in the trade unions and so on, do have memories of Spain, and I'm very glad to met Duncan and Mary, who are in the International Brigades Memorial Trust, you know. So I think in the labour movement there are memories of Spain, and
okay.
people know about it.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I'll just go back to Duncan Mary there. I mean, it was primarily support for sort of democracy, but was it mostly politically left wing sort of people and socialists that went to support the International Brigade?
Well, according to my father, his version of it was that the government of the day then was fairly moderate in content, in fact slightly right-wing in his view. And to say it was communist-led is incorrect. His figures say there were 17 members of parliament at the time that Franco launched his attack on the Republican government.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what. Remind us when is the plaque going to be revealed and what events?
This is the 14th of April.
The 14th of April.
12 midday.
At 12 yes. midday on the 14th.
It will of only be a short ceremony, you know, just to.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how it's represented in popular culture. I mean, in particular, I suppose Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, I suppose, would be a starting point, and Picasso's Guernica. How do you find sort of it represented in popular culture? Do you find it's in the UK? Do you think it's sort of fairly realistic? Or
I think people have heard of Guernica because it's such a striking picture, and of course now it is in Spain after many years not being there. I mean, Guernica was a crucial moment in the Civil War because this small town in the Basque Country was bombed by the Condor Legion, by the Germans, basically. And it was the first example of what's called carpet bombing. Mm-hmm. They went in and they didn't just drop a few bombs in, they kept going in and out and dropping more and more bombs until the whole place was flattened.
Okay, Mary?
Yeah.
The Spanish Civil War was really a rehearsal for the Second World War on the part of Hitler's troops and also Mussolini's troops, because Franco was heavily supported by Hitler and Mussolini, who gave massively of arms and men, whereas the Spanish Republic was very much starved of armaments by the Pact of Non-Intervention, which was really led by Britain and France. And it's known in many ways as the perfidy of Albion. The way that the British really, in many respects, colluded with Franco.
Okay.
Yes, and in fact, Duncan and Mary were saying that to join the international brigades, because the British government had a non-intervention position, you weren't allowed to go. So they apparently, Mary was saying, you had to go in Wales, you had to go to a little bookshop in Cardiff, have a password.
Yeah, it was very clandestine.
Yes, it was all very cloak and dagger, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
I see. Do you think sometimes people have a slightly over-romanticised view about the kind of people that went to support it? Because I suppose we've got like Orwell and Laurie Lee and people like this. Do you think, how realistic an image do you think people have of the kind of people that went to support the International Brigades?
I'm not sure how well. I don't know, really. The majority of people who went were very ordinary working class people. From Wales, it was a lot of miners. In Scotland, it was, again, Scottish miners or ship workers, trade unionists. There were left-wing intellectuals as well who went, and people from quite aristocratic families. A nephew of Winston Churchill went and fought. And there were people who went from Cambridge who had, and Oxford and Cambridge and other universities, who had quite privileged backgrounds. But the majority of people were actually very working class and often unemployed.
John, tell me a little bit. I mean, if you've sort of studied that period, I guess you're using material of the time, i.e. interacting with a lot of media of the time. Looking at the way wars are reported these days, how do you think the reporting of things has changed over the years?
Well, there were a lot of accounts, contemporary accounts of the war, with a fairly unbiased approach towards the issues involved. But of course, they were very limited and restricted by the nationalists. And where most of the archive material that I've seen anyway comes from is from Madrid and the siege that eventually broke and led to the capital being taken over by the troops. Coming back to the point about historical memory that Duncan mentioned, we have an image of the Civil War. People in general can see it through films. I can recall a film made only a few years ago that had as its centre the story of a village and its traumas as the troops came in.
Mm.
The socialist government in Spain up to today, 3 years ago, passed a law of historical memory, which has broken the silence that was agreed upon after democracy came. In fact, democracy was only enabled in Spain by a mutual pact of silence over what happened, who was responsible, who were the criminals in the act of rebellion against the Republic.
Okay.
And that's now been able to be released. People can talk about it. People who lost their loved ones that were dead, left for dead in unmarked graves,
mm-hmm.
in mounds by the roadside in the mountains. Now all of that can come out, and it's being talked about with some resistance from the right wing in Spain. And historical memory is now an important way of reconciling today's truth of Spain with an event of so many years ago.
Okay, but do you think this release of historical memories come sort of at the right time, do you feel, or too early?
Well, it's taken a long time. I mean, yeah. Considering the war ended in 39,
yeah.
in 1939, it's taken a very, very long time because, you know, as John said, the transition to democracy after Franco's death was done on the assumption that the left would keep quiet about the past and the torturers, nothing would happen to them, you know. The people who'd been waterboarding, the prisoners,
okay, so, yeah.
They were allowed to retire on good pensions, you know.
Okay.
So,
well, I've got to kind of wrap things up, I think, but I'll cross back to Duncan and Mary. I mean, how many surviving fighters are there in the UK, do you think, right now? I mean, how many people are you sort of...
Very few, because it was such painful, a long time
yes,
ago.
Yeah.
Mm. There is a small number still alive, and last June, I think it was, they were given Spanish citizenship.
Yes.
And awarded Spanish passports.
Okay.
And that was quite an important event that was held in the Spanish embassy in London.
Okay. And what would you like to think would best be remembered for their efforts here or in Spain, I suppose?
I think the continued fight against fascism.
Hmm.
Because, you know, fascism's still very much alive. And there's always a huge threat that something like the Second World War could happen again.
Hmm. And do you hope that people of the modern day of a similar sort of mind for supporting democracy would do the same thing wherever, you know, if it was in the Middle East or in Iran or somewhere, and go and fight abroad again, if necessary?
I don't know whether that would happen. I suppose in some ways it does. There are people who go off and fight. I think that's what makes the Spanish Civil War so different, is that the vast numbers of people who went and fought for the cause, because they didn't really get paid. They went because they wanted to fight for the Spanish Republic and to fight against fascism, to try to stop the Second World War.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Palmyra Sullivan, John Holloman, Duncan Longstaff and Mary Greening Hall for coming in today. And it's been wonderful to speak to you all and to have some memories shared and stories told.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, the next guest I'd like to interview, Mr. Tony Arpino from San Francisco. Hello.
Hello there.
Lots of those there. Well, tell me, how long have you been in Bristol?
4 years now.
Okay, so yeah. Not long enough to lose your distinctive accent, at least.
No, but I am studying English as a second language.
Okay, how do you find Bristolian accents?
It's, well, I guess the old accent is disappearing. It's still there, but you hear it sometimes, but... It's kind of homogenous now, I guess. Kind of sad, I would think.
Okay.
But I think it's the same even with the Somerset accent in the surrounding country. That's still there. You can still hear it, but it's kind of dying out.
Okay, well, we're going to chat a little bit about sort of connections and similarities between San Francisco and Bristol. Tell me a little bit about San Francisco in the archetype of what San Francisco is about. So it's a haven for hippies, free thinkers, anarchists, and a big gay community, and everything that keeps Republicans awake at night staring at the ceiling. Is that roughly about right?
It is. San Francisco votes completely opposite of the rest of the state of California.
Okay.
Like clockwork, almost always. It's kind of a separate country, surrounded by California.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very left wing, and even across the bay in Berkeley and Oakland, it's the same part of the city spirit, I think. Where the 60s started in that area.
Yeah. So did you grow up there from birth? Are you
No, I've lived in San Francisco on and off for 30 years.
Okay.
But no, I wasn't born there.
Okay. So back in the 70s, what were you? Were you an archetypal San Franner in
Almost. I arrived in San Francisco about 74, 73.
How old were you at the time?
I was young. I was in my 20s.
What did you do there?
I was living in the West in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, might as well go all the way, completely go to California. Why not? It was almost half, more than halfway there, three quarters of the way there. So we just continued on to the Golden State.
Okay, and was it particularly golden? Were you like a man who goes to London expecting the streets to be paved with gold, and you were disappointed, or did you find what you were looking for?
It was no, I don't think I was disappointed at all. I stayed for 30 years. Must have liked it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a good place.
Okay. So what's brought you to England?
Oh, well, I fell in love with an English woman.
Okay.
Who lives in Bristol. And these things happen. Thus, I am here.
Okay. I mean, it has been heard that Bristol is supposed to be the San Francisco of England. Do you think that might be over-egging it a little bit, possibly? Or
no, I think it's spot on. There's a lot of similarities.
Okay.
Well, they both have a famous harbor,
mm-hmm.
San Francisco Bay and the floating harbor. They have hills. They both have famous hills. They have a very cool scene, they're very artistic cities, a lot of coffee houses.
Yeah.
And they both have a famous suspension bridge.
Oh, of course, yes.
Really, they should be sister cities.
Yeah.
And of course, who are the sister cities? Some town in France, but I think we could start a trust.
Yeah, definitely
for that. No.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about how you find the idea of Bristol as a city. I mean, what we call a city, I think you probably call a small town in America. I mean, how big is San Francisco?
That's another interesting thing. They're really not that different in size. The metropolitan area of San Francisco is many cities that surround it, which is quite huge, I suppose. That's millions. But San Francisco itself is on the tip of a peninsula. It can't grow. It's a small city, maybe 700,000.
Mm-hmm.
What's Bristol? 400,000 or 500,000.
Yeah.
They're quite almost the same size.
Okay.
That's kind of interesting there.
Yeah, definitely. What do you miss about San Francisco that you can't get in here in Britain? Sunshine?
Well, no, that's another similarity I should have mentioned, actually, between Bristol and San Francisco. The weather's terrible in both cities.
Right, okay.
It's especially freezing cold in San Francisco in the summer.
Yeah.
They don't tell the tourists that. You always see the tourists shivering in shorts waiting for the cable car. But the fog comes in the summer. It can be quite cold. It's right there at the Golden Gate, so you're on the ocean, really.
Okay.
It's surrounded by California, but it's not always California weather.
Okay, so what's the best time of year to go, then, do you think?
Or the autumn.
Yeah?
I think, yeah. September, October is fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Describe a little bit of San Francisco in the autumn. What's
Well, it's finally gets hot. But I wouldn't say you can go swimming or surfing without a wetsuit any time of year.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people in Bristol get a bit romantic and sort of teary-eyed when they mention trams, because we did used to have one, and there was talk for many years of us rekindling this interest in trams, and it never happened. Explain a little bit about the pros and cons of trams.
Well, trams, there are still trams in San Francisco, of course. The cable cars, there's a number of lines that still work every day. But, of course, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, there were a lot more. And they've since gone to electric and to diesel and white gas buses. But they do still have a few. Unfortunately, Bristol doesn't. That was all changed. some years back. But yeah, that's a.
So, what should a tour if I want to go to San Francisco? I mean, what sort of things could I be looking out for? And what good places to go? Are there any like really cheesy tourist places you probably think should be?
There are. You might Fisherman's Wharf. There's still an active fishing fleet there, smaller, of course, than it was in years past. But the Fisherman's Wharf is also surrounded by tat, I think it's called in British.
Right, kitsch.
Yes, there's you might want to stay away from that. There's another whole pier there that you could give a miss because that's a tourist trap.
Okay. That's very handy.
Dipped in Disneyland.
Okay. I mean, as I guess San Fran, I mean, you must have pretty sort of strong interest in sort of creativity, I guess. It must have rubbed off on you. How'd you find the creative and sort of artistic scene in Bristol and compared to San Francisco?
Well, it's just as exciting, I think. There's a lot jumping here. Just like San Francisco in many ways. There's an active poetry scene. There's art. There's a great muralista tradition in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is... There's a great street art tradition here in Bristol.
Okay.
Very similar. They might be older in San Francisco because of the Spanish muralista tradition, but there's beautiful art on buildings everywhere you look. It's kind of cool that way.
Okay. I understand eagerly listeners will know the name Chatham because we've done features on Thomas Chatham, the great boy poet. I understand you've been ensnared by the legend of Chatham and you've signed up to the Thomas Chatham Society, is that right?
Yeah, Bristol's a kind of an intoxicating place for a poet.
Yeah.
And the romantic movement started here with, Chatterton was a little earlier as kind of the Gothic hippie.
Okay.
But Coleridge, Wordsworth, Southey, their books were first published here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I understand you've written a sort of fairly brief poem about Chatterton, is that right?
I do have a poem about Chatterton, and I'll read it now. I thought of Chatterton today, the boy poet of my new hometown, and the other boy poets I have known and been. They were young men, of course, no longer boys, but pretty and intense and not really crazy, toying with the ancient and new ways of seeing. For 5 seasons now I've passed his house, his uncle, the sexton of St. Mary Redcliffe, and I find the house is not as old as I expect. It's the parchment forgeries of the old monk, a handful of centuries confused in hypertext that flicker in my mind's backlot book of days. Contemporaries of the atmosphere of heaven, walking the mazy lanes, eyelids in romantic movement, a long line unrolling from the inner inkpot. Later, in the anthems, we were the mods of Main Street, dressed like troubadours with electric combs. Memory is the love song of eternity.
And now you know why he read the poem earlier on so excellently, because Tony Arpino from San Francisco, hello, is a poet himself. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Time for our feature from Tony Gosling now, regarding the Northern Ireland conflict this week. It began hundreds of years ago, and British soldiers were called in 1969. Richard Cowley served in the British Army in 1980, and here he describes the daily barracks life of the ordinary British soldier.
In the barracks itself, we used to stag on at this. If anyone ever lived in Auchincloy, or as Irish ever hears this, and they might remember the big square-looking sort of turret at the top of the base, you know, surrounded by barbed wire. We used to spend a lot of time in there reading porn mags mainly. We were supposed to be looking out the slits in the windows, you know. We were given kit like, I think, some sort of night vision, you know, goggles or telescope, but it never really worked. The batteries were always out. So if we did get attacked or compromised by the IRA, you know, we saw a few fields from where we were. It was all very semantic and rather routine in that way.
Yeah. Was there a culture of pornography in the army?
As a matter of fact, I think there was. You know, back in the barracks, people were basically passing around, and when we even if we were on something called QRF, Quick Reaction Force, we also used to congregate dressed and ready to go, you know, at the drop of a hat. And during that time, we would be sitting around for about 2 or 3 hours doing nothing. So we all just to watch TV, and some for some reason, people used to have a brand new video at least once a week, various porn, you know, that kind of stuff. So that was fairly routine, yeah.
Did you have much contact with the local people whilst you were there?
When we first arrived there, we were barracked up in Belfast for a couple of days. We were taught riot training and stuff like that. That was quite interesting, good fun. Being messed about by MPs, however, wasn't good fun. You know, they tended to be different from us. We used to call them crapheads, basically.
Was this the military police?
Yeah, the military police. They wear the same coloured beret, but it's a different kind of red. They have a different attitude, you know. And
What were they like then?
Well, horrible, sort of like lizardish. What? Didn't like them much anyway. Their attitudes are different, you know.
And what kind of things would they be pulling you up for?
Well, they would just boss us around while we're there, basically. Raw recruits telling us what to do, essentially. They were okay, really, you know. They'd seen it all before. Just another lot of infantry, basically, we were. I think they didn't like the Red Berry much, though, because there's this, you know, there's this stigma attached to it for some reason. But we moved on from training, which was the riot training I said about, and then we went into other type of training, which was how to use weapons and how the yellow card process, stop and search, that kind of stuff, all the legal routines that you'd learn when basically about a week. And then after the basic introduction to training, we were taught what plastic bullets did and what how to use a batten gun and rubber bullets and all that kind of stuff on targets, essentially, you know. And then we were bussed out to our barracks.
But what about the locals? Did you ever have conversations much with the locals at all?
Yeah. We spent a day, and that's all, patrolling the actual streets of the Falls Road, the Bogside, that kind of thing, in Belfast. And this was in, they might even remember us. I think it was at about December or January 1980 to the beginning of 81. That was a very interesting experience for me, because we were able to speak to people, but essentially they didn't like us. You could tell that, because of course we were stopping and searching them on every street corner, you know. And then we found out about Bloody Sunday after that, and obviously there was still a big stigma about that and the paras. Although we were three para, Bloody Sunday was one para. And we even distinguish between our battalions in that way, you know. So
what you're doing is you're stopping people in the street. I'm surprised that you could even really get engage them in conversation, where you've kind of interrupted their day, and then you're sort of not quite strip searching them in the street, but you're going through their pockets, and you know, it must be quite an awkward sort of conversation.
There's no conversation. It's basically routine. when you're not, as you say, virtually on top of them, you know, you might as well have a pair of forensic gloves in your pocket. But they didn't like it. I don't blame them at all. They didn't like the paras. We were fortunate in there for the day, but when we weren't actually stopping people, we were static, looking around us and expecting to be shot at by snipers and stuff like that all the time. You know, it was quite unnerving actually, just for the day being there, walking around, because you know, people do get shot. Yeah, we've had a recent spate, haven't we, from the real IRA. And they've recently, nevertheless, terminated their interest officially, thank goodness. But to buttress the peace and to support the peace myself, having with the experience of recently investigating this to some level, I would just ask people that are in the army at the highest level and in the lowest level of any of the MOD forces in total. To maintain a vigilant regard for the troubles of the last 30 years and expect a few sparks out of the fire, maybe, but don't get down too heavy on the matter. And I think we're going to basically approve, you know, of moving ahead with a Conservative government. I'm fairly sure that that's going to be the case within the next 4 years into Northern Ireland, and address that question practically by reinforcing and establishing the preserve of peace where possible. Financially as well, you know, looking into economy, jobs, and the routine of equality of employment and stuff like that. I think it's going to be a lot better in the next 10 years.
Well, that was ex-Parachute Regiment Northern Ireland veteran Richard Cowley there, talking about his thoughts about prospects of peace after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement.
Time from Malcolm Greaves, straight out of Swindon, to read his this week's instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Here is Honey Tones to talk about whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Egg Hunting, 1932. This afternoon, I went out with my little girl to collect the eggs. The farmhouse nestles into the slope on one side of the lane, and the farm buildings lie on the other, immediately opposite. But when we set out on our expedition, we did not go over to the farm buildings at all. Instead, we walked up the hill to a large pasture. There we found a row of poultry houses, each shaped somewhat after the fashion of Noah's Ark. Actually, they are combined houses and runs, in each of which 25 hens live and have their being. They are never allowed outside their dwelling for one moment. I am glad that I am not a hen. Each ark is divided into a run without a floor, and a roosting and laying compartment which has a slatted floor. There is a self-feeder in the centre of the run from which the inhabitants of the ark can help themselves to grain as they will. A bucket of water is suspended on one side of the self-feeder and a container of grit on the other. These containers have to be suspended so they do not touch the ground as the ark is moved on to fresh ground daily. The nesting boxes have a double bottom of half-inch mesh wire netting, the two layers being some 3 inches apart. But this is the gem of the whole contrivance. A hole large enough for an egg to drop through is made in the top layer of the netting in each nest. In actual practice, 98% of the eggs are put through these holes by the hens, with the result that they are collected in a clean condition and do not have to be washed, which, as every poultry farmer knows, destroys that attractive bloom which the new-laid egg possesses. It is obvious that there is less than an even money chance that a hen, we'll call this one Polly for differentiation, will lay her egg through the hole in the netting. One would imagine that, with the natural perversity of the female sex, she would do her utmost not to do so. But Polly does not know the inventor of this contraption as well as some of us do. Presumably, nobody will ever know how he arrived at his knowledge of the laying hen's movements. It is conceivable that he spent hours spying through a peephole, specially bored for the purpose, on Polly and her sisters while they were in the act of laying. Surely, a most ungentlemanly thing to do. But I would not put it past him. Anyway, somehow or other he found out all he wanted and made his hole in the top layer of wire netting accordingly. What actually happens is this. Polly lays her egg at the side of the hole in the netting, gets up, turns around to have a look at it, and then leaves the scene of action cackling in triumph at having outwitted the inventor. Shortly afterwards, her sister Susie enters the laying compartment, observes Polly's egg, and, spurred on by her sister's example, sits down to carry on the good work. Of course, wire netting is not like a comfortable nest of straw, and Polly's egg is the lump in the mattress, so to speak. Susie, therefore, who cannot sit down comfortably straight away and get on with her own egg laying, has to screw herself around a little, and in doing so, she screws Polly's egg through the hole. And so it goes on. The manifold advantages of these poultry runs are fairly obvious. The hens are safe from foxes,
They are under control and they have not got to be shut up at night. Anyone who has had that little job tacked onto his or her work every evening, weekdays and Sundays, throughout the year will appreciate this. A minimum of labour is required, as a lad can move the houses quite easily onto fresh ground daily by means of an ingenious lever. This daily moving ensures healthy poultry free from vermin, and as the floor of the sleeping compartment is slatted, the manure drops through onto the ground, thus fertilising the pasture regularly and efficiently. And as I have described, the eggs are clean when collected. It is amazing, too, how well the hens lay when confined in these houses and getting no free range of any kind. I've come to the conclusion that boredom has a lot to do with it. Once they have exhausted the treasure trove on the fresh piece of ground to which their abode is moved each day, they have nothing else to do, nowhere else to go. So they may as well lay eggs, just to pass the time. As I've said before, I'm glad that I am not a hen. Well, we spent quite an interesting afternoon collecting the eggs, but I could not help contrasting it with my own experiences while collecting eggs on this same farm some 30 years ago. My child does not obtain anything like the joy and excitement from the job that I did. Indeed, our expeditions have only one thing in common. In each case, the collector carries a basket. In my childhood, you didn't just collect the eggs. You hunted them. The farm buildings were one glorious muddle. The hens laid anywhere and everywhere, and dangers lurked around every corner. First there was the gander. How I have run, hand in hand with my small sister, away from that bad-tempered policeman of the farmyard. My own legs were thin and my knees were knobbly in those days, but my sister's were plump and rounded. And the thought of that gander pecking at those luscious pink lovelinesses caused us to scuttle in sheer terror. One hen always laid in the bull's manger, and you had to be very brave at 10 years old to collect that egg. In every loose box and outhouse there might be eggs, and still more exciting, hens still sitting on them. These lazy fowls are poked in great daring with a stick until they flew madly into our faces with their efforts to reach the doorway. Every old implement, every old milk churn lying on its side, and every dim recess in the buildings might, or might not, yield treasure trove into excited, grubby little hands. In one place there was a small, dark roosting house over a cart shed, which was connected with the ground by a flimsy ladder constructed to bear the weight of a hen. In those days, it often carried a small, fearful boy, whose daring was rewarded with a hands and knees exploration of a filthy loft under the tiles, while a still smaller sister watched anxiously from below for his reappearance into the light of day. During the summer, there was always a pile of sheep cribs in the cart house, which meant that you had to become a human ferret in order to retrieve the spoil, for the laying hens penetrated to its farthermost recesses. And once I got stuck and was rescued by an ancient dairyman who said that I was a varmint and a young limb, and that I ought to be twart smartish. My own child has never been called either a varmint or a limb, neither has she been twart smartish. These excitements of a bygone age, she will never know. And when all the out-of-the-way places had been searched, we attacked the main hen house, which was a gloomy, filthy place. There we swelled our bag quickly, and if truth be told, garnered fleas in addition to the eggs. But it was all glorious. To be brought up happily on a farm in those days was a great thing for a child, and when, in afterlife, he finds that he has not been uprooted from his birthplace, he should obtain much happiness from the discovery. To be firmly rooted in such a permanent, lovely thing as a piece of England's land is no small blessing. And today I am thankful for my good fortune in that I am still farming the farm on which I was born.
Thank you to Malcolm Greaves for that excellent reading of Headstrippings, courtesy of A.G. Street. Well, it's time as ever to welcome Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimble Hill and the Bard of Dalek Radio, no less. Hello.
Hello again, John.
What surprises do you have for us this week?
Well, I had a phone call earlier this afternoon saying the theme was you're doing stuff on the Spanish Civil War, so it was a war theme to the programme this week. So.
Okay, there is indeed.
The contemporary conflict is Afghanistan, so, mm-hmm. So this is about that. Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, our leaders say they have a plan to bring peace to your troubled land and get rid of the Taliban. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, O deathbed of the Russian bear, and now our sons are dying there to get rid of the Taliban. The Taliban are bad, bad men. Our soldiers never will know when they'll meet their end to serve the plan to get rid of the Taliban. Afghanistan is old and wild. Some think that it cannot be styled to meet the purpose of the plan for a westernized Afghanistan. The Taliban don't want us there. That's why they killed the Russian bear. They killed the bear, they kill the Brits, they blast their enemies to bits. Who are told they must be calm and brave and always be non-partisan and be prepared to meet their grave to help promote the Western plan. And in the plan, the world will be made safe for our democracy. So then Afghanistan will see that they too can be truly free. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, our leaders still believe their plan, though a hydra-headed monster can disrupt the plans of a Western man. Afghanistan is old and wild, where democracy's a foreign child, who offends the native Taliban, who do not want the Western plan. We must defeat the monster there, or else its tentacles will spread. All nations must take on their share until the Taliban are dead. Brown and Obama say we must not leave until the war is won. They say we must extend our trust to end the rule of bomb and gun. But Afghanistan is old and wild, and democracy is a Western child. And we worry whether this child can bring peace to wild Afghanistan.
Thank you very much, Trevor Carter.
Thank you, John. We've got a short one here.
Ooh.
This is a villanelle.
A bonus feature.
A villanelle, bonus this week.
Okay, yeah. What is the villanelle?
The villanelle is a very specific rhyme form, and it consists of 19 lines. There's a lot of repetition in it. We get the idea, is it? The most famous one is by Dylan Thomas, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." It's one that most people have heard of.
Yeah.
But that is probably the most famous ever villanelle.
Read
but
on.
It creates its mesmerising effect by the use of repetition.
Right.
Yeah. Secret burden. Remembering his past, he wept. Although the wars were long ago, for all the secrets that he kept. He tried too hard to be adept and not to let them know. Remembering his past, he wept. Long suppressed, yet back they crept and would not let him go, those dark secrets that he kept. He'd kept them in the dark, except sometimes his thoughts would show. Then, remembering his past, he wept. For all that he could not accept, he feared the hammer blow, for all the secrets that he kept, for all the feelings that had slept, and burdened him with woe. Remembering his past, he wept for all the secrets that he kept.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Well, time once again for our very own Jeff Sparks and the What's on Guard for this week in Bristol. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's on Guard from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 14th of April, and the Chloe Cook Band, Hold to This, Nights at the Circus, Sound of Sirens, Alien Stash Tint and Silhouette Showgirls will all be performing in Stage 1 of the Surface Unsigned Festival at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance and £7 on the door. On to Thursday, 15th of April, and Burning Skies will be performing with support from True Valiance, Through the Abyss and Centuria at the Croft in Stoatscroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Into Friday, 16th of April, Ruby Turner will be performing with support from Jocanda at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £16 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Amos Milburn. He recorded from the late 1940s onwards and was a boogie-woogie pianist who influenced many musicians of that genre and also rock and roll. This is the track Potluck Boogie from the album Blues, Barrel House and Boogie Woogie, the best of Amos Milburn, 1946 and 1955. Amos Milburn with Potluck Boogie from the album Blues, Barrel House and Boogie Woogie. Moving on to Saturday 17th of April, Cable Co will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on 17th of April, Higher On Maiden will be performing with Mentallica at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 18th of April, Asaph Circus Trio will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show. Much thanks to Tony Alpino, Palmyra Sullivan, John Holliman, Duncan Longstaff and Mary Greening for their contributions. And as always, to Trevor Carter for his poetry and Jess Box for giving us What's On. Little reminder, remember earlier on Palmyra Sullivan was talking about a plaque to Bristolians who fought in the International Brigades. Has been refurbished and redecorated, and it's going to be reopened on Castle Park on the 14th of April at 12 p.m. If you want to find out a little bit more, I'll give you, well, you can always just look up the International Brigade Memorial Trust on the internet. Their website is www.international-brigades.org.uk, and I chatted to Duncan Longstaff about it, and you can always email him duncanlongstaff@btinternet.com, and I'm sure that will get you the information that you need. The features were by Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Greaves read Head Streamings by A.G. Street. The studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and the producer was Anthony Page. And it's goodbye from me, John Peters Common, and that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio. Goodbye!